There is this thing. Do you realize what is? There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this.
The following podcast was created by the Off the Hour News Collective at CKUT radio station in Montreal. It's a culmination of 5 days of broadcasting from May 22nd to May 27th, leading into the May 28th Day of Action across Canada, held in honor of solidarity across borders and the struggles of immigrants and refugees everywhere. You will hear from public figures, activists, and of course, the voices of the refugees and the immigrants facing detainment and deportation.
I'm here with Amir Haddad, who's an Egyptian refugee who's been living in Montreal. And Amir, you have a deportation date set for this coming Thursday. Can you reflect on this and tell us how you're feeling around this?
It's horrible feeling. Sometimes I feel that I'm lost. Sometimes I feel good also because I have a lot of support and I will be okay eventually. I think I got this feeling from friends and comrades. Mm-hmm. My situation was like, if you go and fight on such issues, you could be deported any time and you will lose your case. And this all was in my mind, and I claim that I was like politically aware and I have some political conscience through my life. So what about people who just came and just willing to live, and they know that the immigration has this strong sword on their neck? They could cut this neck any time. So I know that this is a very hard situation for organizers and activists, and I really appreciate this hard work.
One thing that I find very interesting is that you're still making the links between your own situation and the situation of other non-status people around you.
One turning point here on CGED, the story of this girl who was deported in spite of the fact that she was the best student in science in her class, and she's only 17 years old. And for one reason or another, I felt like I am so connected to this situation, and I have to fight now. I mean, it was like more than you could take in one sense or another. I lived. But what about this girl who never lived before? The immigration or the system deport people like that, and they don't take and consider this talented or those gifted people. And what could they do for others and for themselves, mm-hmm. and for the society in general? Mm-hmm. I feel better when I put my story among other stories, and just it is one story of others. The world is full of shit sometimes. So you are not the only one. Maybe this also gave me some kind of strength.
You wrote an article that's been published called "Non-Status Equals Non-Human."
Yeah, I mean, is like I feel like we are completely reduced to one dimension. The good black is the black, and you know, mm-hmm. stuff like that. The good refugee is not the dead refugee. The good refugee is a slave who accepts being a slave, hoping that one day he will be able to move on. If you just put somebody in situations that maybe after 3 years or 4 years you will be able to live like everybody else. I just was trying to explain why this situation is so alienative situation. What is the economical and power relations and behind that situation, and what discourses are being used to justify such a situation of what was my limits in this society. So it is fighting against the limits. It is fighting, it's trying to liberate yourself.
Can you just talk about what you think will happen if you are deported to the United States and then later to Egypt?
In the United States, I got information that I will be detained. You know, I lived illegally in the United States, so by law I will be detained. For how long, I don't know. Then from the United States, I go to Egypt to buy travel documents where it is, you are by law, you are not allowed to ask for political asylum in other country, because they consider it like you are giving bad impressions about the political system. Egypt is one of the most brutal regimes in the Middle East and maybe in the world, and its record of human rights is full of violation of human rights, and which is condemned by a lot of international organizations. So we're speaking about a situation which will be very hard, but I am also relying on my supporters and my friends. This will not pass. A lot of activists in the street are being fucked over every day. Police brutality had reached the higher point of practicing violence. This in custody now is something normal. And it happens to normal people who are not activists or politicians. If the officer of the cop got angry against somebody, he may kill him, and there is no charge for that.
Is there a message that you would want to pass on if you had to leave a message with your friends and comrades and people here in Montreal?
I'm willing. I hope that I will, or I wish that I will be able to stay to continue fighting this system. And if it is not possible, so I hope that this fight will continue.
I am Dr. Amir Kadir from Union des Forces Progressistes, member of Union des Forces Progressistes. The case of the refugees that we have expelled to the United States and who have been sent back home and then somehow have been tortured to extort information for U.S. authorities, we should be very open in front of our people. And the Canadian government should say, yes, we agree that the United States subcontracts other countries to torture individuals in order to get information. Do we agree as Canadians with that? No, I think. And the people gathered here today are here just to say that.
What? No one is illegal.
No. What? No one is illegal.
We are in a post-September 11 context where the security delirium, the security propaganda waged by the United States in order to justify its foreign policy in the Middle East has just done that, profiling and putting all the focus on people from Middle East and Western Asia in order to justify the restraints put on civil liberties here and to justify big military and security expenses, which are instruments of U.S. domination around the world.
We will now hear an interview recorded in Beirut, Lebanon, with Ahmed Abdel Majid, in which he reflects on his experiences organizing against Palestinian deportations from Canada.
My name is Ahmed Abdel Majid, a Palestinian from Ain Helwi camp, which is located in the south of Lebanon. It contains about 75,000 of Palestinian people.
I have a big family. I have 6 brothers, 1 sister. Right now, I feel that I am a persecuted in Lebanon, that I don't have a civil rights. I don't have a right to work. I don't have anything. Like, I'm feeling like an animal, that I don't have any rights, just living in a small camp. If you went to Canada, you can't work, you can't study, you can't do everything. And after 3 years or 4 years, you can get a citizen as a refugee. So I went there and applied as a refugee status.
You had to write your whole life story in 3 or 4 pages.
There's 4 or 5 papers that not of them I need to fill up. But actually there is information about ID, my ID, like my name, my family name, my father's name, and information about my family, or they live your address or something like that. And there's one page like I need to make a short story about my life, why I need to apply for a refugee status. Really, I felt afraid when I applied as a refugee status, and I wrote about my story that I felt no one live like Palestinian people in the camp. There is this strange people, no one knows about them. I feel afraid that I'm sitting in front of the judge. This is the first time of my life I sit in front of a judge. He always asked me about my own story, like he didn't believe me, and I'm telling him true story. And I told him that if he didn't believe me, he can ask the Lebanese government, can ask the Canadian embassy in Lebanon, that's true or not.
And how did you feel about your whole life being judged by this one person, this one Canadian, who had never traveled to the camps, who'd never been in Lebanon?
I had a bad feeling that I should tell him all my story in like a few minutes, 20 or 30 minutes. I need to tell him about all my life.
The morning that you received the paper that said that you were refused, and how you felt when you read that?
Just one line, just short answer, that you are refused because you have the same conditions as the Palestinian refugee in Lebanon. Well, I didn't believe that. Really, I didn't believe. At that time, I called my lawyer and told him that it's true or not that I got refused from the court.
After you were refused refugee status in Canada as a Palestinian, what did you do? What did you want to do?
I applied for another court, but also they refused. Then I applied as a PRRA. And also after 2 months, they refused me. When I applied the PRRA, someone with the immigration called me at my house and gave me an appointment to meet him in his office. There's a lady, I told her that I already got married from a Canadian woman. She told me that even if you get married and have children, we will deport you. You have 2 months to leave Canada. So I met Palestinian guys that work with human rights. So there is only a solution to work with them to get my own papers.
And working with people and other Palestinians who are in the same situation as you, how did you feel?
It's a good feeling because all of them work in the same case, and all of them try to help each other, make a good relation like brothers. All the world is my land because I don't have any land. If I went to anywhere, it would be my land because I don't have a land as a Palestinian people. I was born as a refugee.
We're now going to go to some presentations that took place at the People's Commission on Immigration and Security Measures. First, we are going to be hearing from Sharon Aiken, who's a professor of law at Queen's University.
The most important point I want to make today is that race thinking, which is captured in the phrase, they are not like us, that kind of thinking becomes embedded in law and bureaucracy, so that you have a terrifying union of state machinery and race thinking. One that's one scholar called the dance of bureaucracy and race, and I think that's what we most need to keep in mind. When people are cast out of legal community and political community, when we suspend their rights, that is a move that is legally made. As many scholars have called that, that's the force of law without law. Where people perform extraordinary acts of racism and violence in the name of duty, defense of country, patriotism. So that one outstanding feature of racial violence is that racist effects become sort of routinized and embedded in arrangements that systematically cut off people's opportunities on every turn. They are not like us. Well, if that were actually said anywhere else, everyone would say, come on, that's racist, get over it, come up with something better than that. But that's allowed to stand. If they actually say, well, you know, this profile doesn't correspond to fact, the answer to that question again is, well, it doesn't have to. these people are not like us, and they use concepts that powerfully convey that idea. And so we have certain red flags that are used in place of facts and arguments. It has to do with the mysterious, inscrutable, inherently violent, dangerous Arab. And those kinds of images are not new to us. We can call on them for several decades now. We've had those images in place. And so what you find piece by piece in the transcript is those images very cleverly doing the work that logic should do, that law should do.
There is this thing.
For an opportunity to check out the full audio archives of the CKUT radio station in Montreal, including the material that was used to produce this podcast, please visit www.ckut.ca and check out the programming and archives section.
I have seen CSIS, I cannot say too much about that. I know what they've put together. I want to mention something. It's not just the things that we hear about from others who have had worse experiences than we, the dirty tricks operations and so on and so on. It is also their incompetence. The incompetence is, I'm an academic, I know what research is. I cannot believe it. It is a shame to this country, shameful to call this intelligence. This is idiocy.
This is horrible. You're tuned into CKUT 90.3 FM. You were just listening to a presentation from Dieter Miskled, who's the partner of Amparo Torres, who is a Colombian social activist, accepted refugee, now facing deportation on accusations of association with the FARC, which is the one of the major guerrilla organizations involved in the ongoing civil conflict within Colombia. We are now going to go to a presentation from Warren Almond, who's the former Solicitor General of Canada.
These measures have already had an adverse impact on human rights and civil liberties in Canada. Innocent people have been punished and lives have been ruined. In my view, these adverse impacts will continue if our national security laws and policies do not undergo significant change. Furthermore, while the rights of everyone are threatened, experience has demonstrated that Muslims and Arabs in Canada have borne the brunt of this ill-conceived domestic war on terror. Canada's anti-terrorist measures introduced since September 11, 2001 include the Anti-Terrorism Act, or Bill C-36, security certificates under the Immigration and Refugee Protection Act, the Public Safety Act, and lawful access proposals which have not yet been legislated. Already in existence prior to 2001 were CSIS, the Canadian Security and Intelligence Service, certain provisions of the RCMP, the Communications Security Establishment, provisions of the Criminal Code, and the Emergencies Act of 1988. Unfortunately, the government did not consider these sufficient. Each of these new post-9/11 measures purportedly were designed to keep Canada safe from the so-called new threats of terrorism. In many cases, however, these new measures are overly broad and in their application violate human rights and ignore the rule of law. As some of you may know, I've had some experience with these matters, and I'm extremely familiar with issues of law, security, and human rights. I served as Solicitor General for 4 years and 5 years as President of the International Center for Human Rights and Democratic Development. Part of my responsibilities as Solicitor General was to approve requests for electronic eavesdropping, wiretaps, and covert surveillance. And from time to time, I discovered serious mistakes regarding intelligence targeting, which convinced me of the need for effective oversight and scrutiny and tightly focused legislation. Despite what we are repeatedly told by certain pundits, politicians, and some media and armchair experts, the risk posed by terrorism is not new. Canada and its allies have faced serious threats throughout our history, both in times of war and in times of peace. Unfortunately, however, Our responses on questions of national security have not always been fair and respectful of the rule of law. Take, for example, the treatment of Ukrainians in the First World War and Italian and Japanese Canadians during the Second World War. In both cases, xenophobia, cross-fertilized with fear and ignorance, resulted in racist policies that overwhelmed the rule of law and human dignity. The wrongs done during the world wars were remedied by apologies and compensation offered up decades later, often to the descendants of those who suffered injustice. While these are moral requisites for healing and forgiveness, apologies and compensation are not a real remedy for systemic flaws. The real solution lies in having law and policy conform with our nation's fundamental values and principles in order to avoid similar mistakes in the future. Distilled to their simplest form, the values that define a just society are human rights, the rule of law, and respect for human dignity. This is embodied in our legal traditions and in our Charter of Rights and Freedoms based on the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. The Charter certainly is an amazing document. It reiterates the primacy of the rule of law and entrenches fundamental human rights and freedoms. Unfortunately, the climate of fear since September 11, 2001 has tempered our fidelity to the rule of law and respect for human dignity. We have allowed our fears to intimidate our values and overshadow the very essence of our democratic society. The result has been legislation which ignores our Constitution, our Charter, and our international human rights commitments. Specifically, this legislation provides for excessive secrecy, complicity in unlawful arrest and torture, racial and religious profiling, the criminalization of immigrants and refugees, an attack on privacy, and a growing surveillance society. In my view, these certificates are in serious contravention of Articles 7, 9, 10, 11, and 15 of our Charter. As a result of these provisions, several security certificate detainees, all Arabs and or Muslims, are now under indefinite detention and face the possibility of being deported to torture or death without ever knowing the substance of the allegations against them.
You have been listening to a presentation from Warren Almond, who was the former Solicitor General of Canada. He was speaking at the People's Commission on Immigration and Security Measures, a public event that took place in Montreal in late April.
Carlos Paredes, who is a community psychologist from Guatemala, is on tour in Quebec talking about his experience working with the victims and survivors of the massacre of Pansos.
Pueblo unido está luchando por sus derechos, justa razón, la vida la gros.
So I'm with Nathalie Brière from the Projet Accompagnement Quebec-Guatemala. Can you just talk a bit about the tour and about the work of Projet Accompagnement?
Projet Accompagnement Quebec-Guatemala is an organization that works in solidarity with Guatemala. We exist since 92, and mostly it was to support the refugees who fled the civil war, so that lasted 36 years in Guatemala. And our presence in Guatemala mostly was to accompany them in their process to return to Guatemala in a safe way, if we can say. There was an accord between the government and the refugees that they would settle in some communities that they chose, and they would create a cooperative, and they asked for an international presence so that there wouldn't be any more violations of their rights, or if there would be, by our presence, we could at least tell the world what happened in Guatemala. So that's how we started at first, to train people to go to Guatemala to be with the refugees. And we always had a part of our work that was done here in Canada, in a sense that it was important for us to inform the population here to be aware of what happened in Guatemala and what occurred in terms of human rights. So this is what we are still doing, that part of the work. And now mostly we accompany people who survived the massacres and who are willing to go in court or in the process to bring to justice the military responsible for the massacres. And as part of our work here to inform the population of what happened in Guatemala, we organized a year ago an exhibition, a photo exhibition, and also a paintings that recreated kind of the history of one of the communities, which is Pansos. And so we also brought the artist who took the pictures and the paintings, and we presented it in Montreal. And this year we presented that exhibition in different parts of Quebec. And for the end of the tour of this exhibition, we also wanted to do a tour of conferences from somebody who worked directly with the victims, with the survivors of this massacre in Pansos, so that he can talk about his work with the population and also their struggle to work and build a better society.
You're tuned into CKUT 90.3 FM. You've been listening to an interview with Carlos Paredes and members of the Quebec Solidarity Campaign with Guatemala. This is a presentation by Sonali Kolhatkar, who's the coordinator of the Afghan Women's Mission. It's an organization based in Los Angeles.
What I'm going to do is try to address the situation of Canada and Afghanistan compared to what the U.S. has been doing, and also share with you what ordinary Afghan people want from Afghanistan, because those are the silenced voices. There's nothing that NATO and Canada are doing in Afghanistan that the US hasn't already been doing. There is nothing, and I think Canadians have to be very clear, there's nothing that Canadian troops will be doing in Afghanistan that is not in line with US policy. Let's be really clear, the U.S. is in charge. The U.S. will dictate policy, and Canada will follow, just as the U.K. has been following, just as the rest of the NATO countries have been following. So what is Canada saying that it's doing? What are Canadian generals and the Canadian military saying that they're doing? Well, we had a Canadian general very clearly spell out that Canada's here in Afghanistan to kill. Our job is to kill. And they're joining the United States in an extremely futile exercise in the so-called war on terrorism that is supposed to somehow end terrorism by killing people. Now, what has the U.S. actually been doing in Afghanistan, and has it resulted in a lowering of terrorism? Has it been resulting in a lessening of terrorism? Not at all. In fact, since 2001, you've seen attacks in Afghanistan increase. You've seen the rise of religious fundamentalism once more in Afghanistan. Afghanistan had never known suicide bombings. This was a new phenomenon in that country. However, since last December, there have been dozens of suicide bombings in Afghanistan. In fact, right around when the Canadian military began increasing its troops. And so if the United States policy of fighting terrorism by hunting down and killing Al-Qaeda and Taliban is not working, and if Canada is going to be following that same tactic, what's the point? Where's Canada heading? What are Canadian troops really doing there? How is it possible that Canada could improve on what the U.S. is doing? Probably not likely that Canada is supposedly somehow going to find some miraculous formula to end terrorism where the U.S. itself couldn't. How do you make friends with people while you're busy killing them? And one of the tactics that NATO and Canada have been conducting in Afghanistan is something that the United States pioneered. It's an integration of military and humanitarian work, which is that instead of protecting aid workers, the military is actually doing the aid work for much more money than it would cost an aid organization. And they would basically tell the Afghan people, we're your friend, we're here to help. And aid workers stood back and said, wait a minute. Why are you building a well in school? Why aren't you protecting us while we are building wells in schools? What it did was it made aid workers into targets. And the Al-Qaeda and Taliban and so-called insurgent forces, and basically anybody who wasn't very happy about the presence of military, were targeting aid workers because they were then associated with the military presence. Doctors Without Borders, an organization that had been in Afghanistan for 24 years, through the worst of the worst times, left a couple of years ago. But five of their aid workers were killed, and they denounced this policy of military and humanitarian integration, which Canada is continuing on, NATO is continuing on, the concept of provincial reconstruction teams. So on the one hand, the Canadian military is there to kill, and on the other hand, the Canadian military is there to win the hearts and minds of the Afghan people. How can it do both simultaneously? We have to ask ourselves that question.
CKUT 90.3 FM, you have been listening to the voice of Sonali Kolhatkar, the Afghan Women's Mission. We're now going to go to New York City, the United States. We are joined on the line by Kavita Paria. So maybe can you start by giving us a bit of perspective and idea about your organization, DRUM?
DRUM, which stands for Desis Rising Up and Moving, DRUM has been organizing predominantly low-income, undocumented South Asians in New York City for about 6 years. On May 1st, which is typically International Workers' Day around the world, turned out 1 million people in New York alone, which the NYPD here is calling the largest mass demonstration in New York City's history ever. So we're really seeing a very exciting historic moment in terms of a social justice movement.
Now, can you maybe outline some of the key issues that these major demonstrations in the United States have been focusing on?
The mass mobilizations really, I think, were triggered by the most anti-immigrant piece of legislation possibly in U.S. history, which is called the Sensenbrenner Bill, or H.R. 4437, which would make every undocumented immigrant here a felon, and folks who work with undocumented immigrants or know of someone's status, including family members, subject to time in jail as well. The Department of Homeland Security here has really, really stepped up its efforts to crack down on migrants that are here just trying to earn a living, whether it's been through the increase in detention, a mass increase in deportation, to I think the extent that 1 million people have been deported from the U.S. in the last 10 years. After September 11th, the atmosphere dramatically changed, and an intense amount of racial and religious profiling came down on the South Asian Arab and Muslim communities, as I believe has been the case in Canada as well. If we talk about North American work, that there's been a lot of similarities and trends in terms of government practice as well as collaboration between the U.S. and Canadian governments.
Can you maybe talk about some of the human impacts of these policies, 1 million deportations from the United States? Can you talk about how these immigration laws affect people that you work with as an organization?
One about a year and a half ago of a Bangladeshi member of ours who was who had visited the Department of Motor Vehicles. She went into the DMV. They told her there were no problems. A couple of days later, the Department of Homeland Security showed up at her house at 5 in the morning with and detained and deported her eventually. We worked on that case, and there were no options for her. She had two small children, a one-and-a-half-year-old and a four-year-old, who were both U.S. citizens, had never been to Bangladesh, and were, when she was deported, were also taken back to Bangladesh so that they could be with their mother. You know, that's one example of how these policies come down. You know, I could rattle off so many cases. It's really a daily assault on immigrants in this country.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for taking the time to join us today and to shed some light on the work of your organization, DRUM, and the growing civil rights movement in the United States for the rights of immigrants. We are joined now on the phone by Harsha Walia, who is an organizer with No One Is Illegal in Vancouver. Can you maybe talk about this upcoming National Day of Action? Why is it being organized? What are the key issues that are going to be addressed?
Yeah, absolutely. The National Day of Action is for status for all, but also more broadly for immigrant rights. And one of the key issues is obviously regularization, which is, as you mentioned, also known as legalization, particularly in the context of the U.S. and in more bureaucratic terms, quote-unquote, amnesty. But what we're calling for is status for all, which basically affirms that everyone in Canada should have full permanent residency status. And this is a basic issue of self-determination and justice for those who migrate. But also the broader issues are for immigrant justice in the post-9/11 climate. The men who are being held on security certificates technically have status in Canada, but are continuing to be targeted and profiled because they happen to be racialized minorities. So we're trying to highlight all of these different issues.
So can you maybe describe for people what the non-status communities in Canada's major cities face in terms of day-to-day life? What does living without papers in Canada mean for an individual?
Pretty much everything that people with papers take for granted in Canada, those without status have no access to. One of the most obvious things in living without status is constant anxiety and fear and stress that people cannot even imagine. The fear of every day waking up, every day going to bed with the feeling that at any time someone could be at your door. Every time you cross the street, someone could ask you for your status. Every time your children are in school, they can be nabbed. That kind of fear, no one lives in. That deep-rooted sense of instability and insecurity is something that no one other than the non-status population experience every single day. So it's a complete underclass life, complete life of invisibility below the radar. But these are people that we come in contact with every single day. These are people who work in the service industry, work in the garment industry, work as janitors, pumping gas, as nannies. But they're invisible to us, but because their life has deliberately been invisibilized, but we're in contact with the non-status community every single day. But one of the greatest myths, of course, and challenges that we have to address is this idea that the non-status community are quote-unquote criminals or terrorists because they've come illegally and they're trying to evade the law and they have something to hide. And that's factually not true at all. Like, most non-status actually entered Canada legally. So it's also the way that public consciousness tries to construct and continue to racialize and demonize non-status people, and again try to create this fear and paranoia of the non-status community, who are our neighbors, our friends, our families, that we know every and come in contact with every single day. So there's so many issues that are related not only to status but related to broader issues, social issues of poverty and criminalization and racial profiling and racialization and sexism that immigrant communities deal with every single day that we're also trying to highlight.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for taking the time to join us today.
Thanks, Krista.
We've been speaking with Harsha Walia, who's an organizer with No One Is Illegal in Vancouver. We're now going to go to an interview with Dolores Chu, who's one of the board members of the South Asian Women's Community Center here in Montreal.
Okay, so today I'm on the phone with Dolores Chu. Dolores, can you tell us a little bit about what you do?
Well, I'm a founding member of the South Asian Women's Community Center. Even though we identify ourselves as a South Asian organization working within this particular community, our services are open to anybody who comes. And from get-go, we've dealt with all kinds of needs that the community faces, and always, you know, issues of migration and refuge, and of course it also sort of changes depending on what's going around in other places in the world, in terms of, you know, sometimes we've had an influx of people from Bangladesh or Sri Lanka, more recently Afghanistan, etc.
And what kind of status do most of the people have that you see? How does that impact on their lives?
Well, very often, you know, people come to the South Asian Women's Center when they're fairly new to the city, and they're usually referred to us. For example, you know, there are flyers about our organization in, say, Quebec Immigration Centers or CLSCs. So very often people will get referred to us when they are new arrivals, and because we can speak you know, many South Asian languages, this becomes very, very useful. But sometimes we also get people who have been here for quite a while, but because the needs are so perhaps culturally specific, or even if they have been here for a long time, they may not have yet got to know what is out there. When they do need certain kinds of services, they end up coming to us.
Have the changes in the government over the years impacted on the lives of the people that you see coming to you, the kinds of stories they tell?
Well, definitely, there have always been issues, particularly with people who either are here as immigrants and are trying to bring over family members, either parents or spouses. There have been, a lot of delays, and sometimes we've had to assist. We've been part of kind of a campaign at one time to hasten the family reunification process. And then particularly after 9/11, the whole, racial profiling, and since we deal with families from places like Bangladesh and Pakistan, where you have, large Muslim majority populations, the kind of racial profiling, the Islamophobia has caused a lot of concern and anxiety in communities that are already under, feel very, very insecure because their status is unsure. Sometimes they are also dealt with in illegal, semi-legal ways by traffickers. So very often when we meet them, they're already under a lot of stress. And, security certificates and things have definitely not helped the criminalization. We found there's been a lower level of tolerance and acceptance. We're often dealing with cases where people are about to be deported. And sometimes we have been able to help simply in getting their cases re-looked at, because perhaps the first time they had an interpreter who wasn't interpreting what they were saying accurately. And in a few cases, we have been fortunate in helping. But there are many people also who are being deported. So there has been a change in terms of the federal government's introduction of security certificates and a general climate of suspicion and fear since 9/11.
Please visit www.ckut.ca and check out the programming and archives section.
Do you realize consciousness is affected? There is this thing on.
Status for All is to achieve basic justice and dignity for people living in fear and anxiety of deportation and detention, and to understand how we are still fighting for these same basic principles today.
We have the idea of setting status for people, and we have to remember that the dominion system is the one that have created first with the native people, those so-called native with status, native without status, etc. The same system was used actually to build apartheid in South Africa. So if you look carefully, what we have now is apartheid in a world global scale, where people without status, people who are not in fact in the information type of society, who have not the skills, well, not money, to be able to have this way of consumption, well, these people are totally marginalized.
Aziz Fall, I thank you very much for leading us into our panel discussion today.
It's my pleasure.
Solidarity Across Borders.
We're now joined by three new guests in studio with us. We have Poya Safari, and joining us on the phone from Toronto, we have Mohan. From Vancouver, we have Harjat. Poya, give us a briefing on what Solidarity Across Borders is.
Solidarity Across Borders is a network of immigrant refugee groups, directly affected groups, as well as allies who have come together over the past 3 years to fight for rights and dignity for immigrants and refugees. This year, we've decided to, as a part of a National Day of Action, to march here in Montreal, demanding status for all refugees and immigrants living here. And our network will continue past this march to continue to work, mobilize for status.
From Toronto, Mohan, are you there?
Tomorrow, we're going to start the march at 1 p.m. just in Toronto, and we're going to march through mainly the communities that have mostly been affected by the recent wave of deportations and public targeting of refugees and immigrants and non-status people in Toronto, and end with a community fair and concert in the park in the center of one of these communities to celebrate the courage and the resistance that non-status people have shown and that they have to show every day just going throughout their daily lives.
From Vancouver, Harjap, are you there?
Yes.
And what is happening in Vancouver tomorrow?
Well, we're going to be having basically a march downtown in Vancouver, starting from the Art Gallery at about 2 o'clock. And we've actually been working through a coalition of organizations through a coalition which is called the Status Coalition. And it's been quite a bit of community groups based in the Middle Eastern, Latino, South Asian, African, Iranian, Chinese, and a whole bunch of other communities that have been actually coordinating some of this work. So the outreach has been really great, and we've got some buses and stuff organized from the suburbs to come from some of the areas where a lot of migrant communities are based, and I guess we're crossing our fingers and looking forward to the day.
Poya, hundreds and thousands of people live without status, and hundreds of thousands of people are being exploited by Immigration Canada policies that are seemingly arbitrary and racist. Might I ask you for some specific examples from Montreal?
Well, basically, I mean, before giving examples, I would just say that, like, the system in general works in that way where it's completely arbitrary. You have judges or IRB members who have no, they're appointed with, like, no knowledge of immigration refugee issues. They're politically appointed. So just to show you where that all starts off, there's no appeal at all, so you can't even appeal a decision. So you're at the mercy of one person. But just to give you some specific examples, the case of two Palestinian brothers from the same refugee camp in Palestine. One is accepted, one is refused. Identical cases. Where's the logic? It's just simply they had different judges. One was sick on the day that he was supposed to show up, and that's it. So, I mean, that just displays the ignorance and the sheer racism is blatant, and people confront it every day, and people continue to resist it every day.
Mohan, if you might be able to provide us with some examples in Toronto.
Yeah, I think, I mean, just to echo what Puya says, we all know how arbitrary the immigration system is, but I think it's also important to talk about that, you know, the reasons we're saying there should be status for all isn't just the humanitarian reason or human rights reason. It's the fact that Canada and, I mean, Canadian businesses, the government, really actually benefit from having people live here without status. I mean, they're forced to work without any rights, without any recourse if they're treated, you know, really poorly at work. They're forced to work for less than minimum wage and really have no rights. And this is, I mean, really benefiting Canadian businesses and governments where they have this pool of cheap labor who have no rights. Some examples of the immigration system targeting people in Toronto, we've seen recently a wave of deportations of construction workers, but also just attacking and targeting people in public places. And it really just does serve to try to keep people scared to speak up for their rights. And I think that's one of the big purposes of this National Day of Action.
And Harjap in Vancouver.
Yeah, well, I think a lot of the examples are very similar. A lot of non-status people obviously working for much under minimum wage. And, you know, like, I mean, obviously we have situations of people in sanctuary still. There's a gentleman that's been here in sanctuary for almost close to two years now. And, you know, again, like, very arbitrary process. His mother was actually accepted on his persecution in Iran, yet he doesn't get accepted by the refugee process. I think it's a really sort of critical that we take a look at this form of exploitation, because what it looks like is that when there's the pressure from migrants all around the world, most of these countries actually want to make it official. They want to make the exploitation official, so they develop these guest worker programs, which are essentially a form of slavery. And I think that's one of the things that we've been looking at here in Vancouver.
But why now? Why is this kind of cross-country mobilization important? Poya, maybe we'll start with you.
As cities, as people across Canada start to resist together, we'll only get stronger, and the movement will only grow as networks build, as people start to work together and start to learn about the specifics of each region and the issues. We will start to have a better understanding of each other's struggles, and the more connection that we have between these communities, the stronger we'll be in the end.
Mohan?
The National Day of Action, these marches are a huge step. They're really a way to bring a lot of the communities together. Now what we're really seeing is a lot of these communities coming together under a single banner and saying that we're all affected by these immigration policies. We have the Tamil community here who's recently come under attack under the guise of anti-terrorist measures. A lot of the Hispanic community groups that have been facing a lot of deportations in the past few months. Prison abolitionist groups, unions, schools, even all coming together under this banner of status for all and saying that no one is illegal and that we're not going to accept this treatment of anyone in our communities.
And finally, Harjap, we'll end with your reflections.
Something that I've been quite, you know, happy to see is that a lot of the communities drawing parallels to what's happened to them historically. It's very powerful to see here the South Asian community right now talking about the Kamagata Maru incident that happened in the early 1900s, and also the Chinese Canadian with their head tax campaign, and also the Japanese community with the Japanese internment. Like, all of these communities coming together to resist collectively and across Canada to show the public that this is a nationwide problem and there are communities resisting across the country.
Thank you again very much to all of our guests. Again, we've been speaking with Poya from Solidarity Cross Borders in Montreal, Mohan from No One Is Illegal in Toronto, and Harjap from No One Is Illegal in Vancouver. Joining us here in the studio, we have Dan, who's from New York City and works with the Anarchist People of Color Network, and Oana, who works with the Organic Collective in San Diego. So a big welcome to all of our guests. What's been happening in New York recently?
It's really exciting, of course. I think one of the most interesting things about, like, the two big demos that happened, one on May Day, one a couple weeks before that, is it wasn't organized by anarchists, socialists, Kaya's UFPJ or ANSWER. It was organized by immigrants. It's really forced a lot of people to really think about, like, well, what does solidarity mean? Who are we organizing for? And how are we going to do work in the future?
What's been happening in the U.S. is kind of unprecedented in a lot of ways. Where do you see that kind of movement going?
Of course, it's going forward. The question that a lot of people are asking is, like, how well integrated will it be with the other issues? How do organizers integrate all of this energy into what they're doing? I came from the global justice movement. Traditionally, solidarity for that meant, like, traveling somewhere and, like, you know, kind of taking part in somebody else's struggle and kind of forgetting what was going on at home. And a lot of people are questioning that and asking of, like, well, what does this word solidarity mean? Does it mean, you know, going out, marching, having some big macho, like, street fighting demo? Or is it, you know, the way you look at something like childcare or, you know, like, the different neighborhoods around where you live and, like, who is being arrested by the cops and all that kind of stuff? And how is that integrated in the things that are going on in the world? And there's more and more groups made up of immigrants that are starting, like, on their own initiative to work with, like, a lot of these folks that have been around for a long time.
Mm-hmm. On the phone from San Diego, when are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
And maybe you can just tell us a little bit about the Organic Collective.
We spent a lot of time mostly dealing with the Minutemen. They kind of look like wannabe right-wing paramilitaries. if you ever run into them, they are armed and they go down, and they resemble people who have hunted migrants at the southern border here for a long time, but they're a little bit more politically savvy. So we've been dealing with them for a while, countering them, going out to the desert to distract their activities, meeting them. They go out oftentimes to day labor sites here where immigrants are trying to get work and, like, harass them, so we try and counter them there. That was, like, pretty much the focus of our work. And then as things really built, we've kind of just tried to figure out the best ways that we can offer support. It's been a little messy. I liked what Dan was saying about how more activist groups start to, you know, interact with immigrant rights groups that are coming up in movement that's coming from immigrants. And we've actually found ourselves being interested in supporting the youth who we feel are not out there for their own political agenda, but are really just pushing for change. And so we've been looking to support them as much as possible.
In Canada, deportation agents have been entering schools and workplaces to create an atmosphere of fear for migrants and people without status. And I was wondering if you in San Diego would have any examples of U.S. Security forces trying to create the same atmosphere of fear.
One, there's the Minutemen side of things, where I feel like, it, in a lot of ways, the Border Patrol agents and what we call ICE, which is Immigration Customs and Enforcement, it's very cut and dry. Like, they're very open with the Minutemen and very, like, consciously against us. And I think that that's been more, like, the traditional like very obvious, like who's playing what roles. Something that we have seen a huge upswing in government agencies popping up on the streets of San Diego, like groups of like ICE agents on the streets asking people for papers.
To provoke and to hassle?
To provoke people, to hassle people. And I mean, in San Diego, there's a huge undocumented community. And I think that that is kind of tied to why they've shown up, is that they're aware of that, and now they're coming more into communities on the spot asking people for papers. They can detain, arrest, deport, you know, wrong place, wrong time, and that can be you, you know, on that corner stopped by that agent.
Now, both in Canada and in the States and in many other countries as well, some of the most frequently cited arguments for stricter immigration controls derive from the fears of those of lower-skilled workers who are responding in part from their own experiences to the systematic problems plaguing the bottom of the labor market. I'm wondering how much you see of a role or obligation towards both appreciating and addressing some of these fears.
Well, I mean, like a lot of immigrants take jobs that no one in the U.S. would want. I mean, it's like really insane to think that like people are taking jobs that like Americans are, you know, away from Americans. I mean, people of color in this country are like largely here because they couldn't survive in their own countries, and it's because, to a large degree, of like the actions of Western nations. I mean, if there weren't any immigrants working in the U.S., the economy would collapse immediately, because our economy is just totally dependent on immigrant labor.
In terms of here in San Diego, and especially living in a place where the Minutemen have such a large presence for how small they are, they've really pushed a lot of the mythology around how immigrants interact with the labor force. So for us, we're pretty much starting at square one, partially because there aren't a lot of us, but I mean literally putting out whatever media we can, whatever literature we can, to start even breaking down the misinformation that the vast, like that the general population believes. We're fighting a huge media machine that's feeding, you know, this is this Minuteman and he says this bunch of lies, and then we have to, you know what I mean, go fight that. One way that we've really addressed it is that we actually went to a lot of organizations in San Diego and said, hey, what are you looking for us to do? We, Organic is not an entirely white group, but we do have a lot of education privilege within the group. We do have a lot of economic privilege within the group. So we asked, and people said, we want you to organize in your community. We want you to talk to people that you can relate to that we don't have access to. And I think that that's how we've tried to do it. I think that that's something that we're really trying to make happen in San Diego, is have organizers learn how to be supportive, not just be leaders because we think that we're the best leaders.
This podcast was created by the Off the Hour News Collective at the CKUT radio station in Montreal and was based on programming from May 22nd to May 27th in honor of the struggles of immigrants and refugees everywhere. For a complete archive of CKUT programming audio, please visit www.ckut.ca and check out the link for programming and archives.
Our consciousness is affected. There is this thing going on.
What is called?
The news brought to you live. Brought to you live. Brought to you live. Brought to you live.